For the week of May 31st, 2009, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 6, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And I'm Karen Woodward, also in Los Angeles.
And I'm Ann Thompson.
Indeed, we're actually very excited to have Ann here. If you're not familiar with Ann, you can, of course, read her blog at thompsononhollywood.com. It's hosted presently on Variety, which I guess, Ann, you could tell us a little bit about what's going on with your blog.
Well, I was there for 2 years, and as you know, the trades are a bit beleaguered these days, and so I'm going to be moving on, taking the blog independent, and probably announcing an affiliation with another site quite soon.
And certainly when you do, we will make sure to tell everybody. Now, you were also with The Hollywood Reporter for a little while as their deputy film editor.
Yeah, and I started blogging there with Risky Biz blog, which was fun. I really enjoyed creating that out of nothing. It was sort of my idea, and it was really fun to watch it take off. And then I went and took a different blog approach over at Variety.
Now, Risky Biz was kind of an offshoot of the LA Weekly column you wrote.
Years ago. Yes,
years
thank
ago.
You for remembering.
Well, and of course, I first met you when you were the West Coast editor of Premiere, and I think just before that, you were working as the West Coast editor of Film Comment. Certainly, Ann has more credentials than many journalists put together.
I was going to say,
that's because I'm old. Been around the block a few times.
And if you want to follow Ann's writing, again, thompsononhollywood.com or on Twitter, AK Stanwyck. We'll put that in the show notes. Now, Ann and I just saw each other in Cannes, and you wrote an interesting, very long piece this week on your blog about the winners and losers of this year's festival.
It was interesting because, you know, the festival is really, you know, it was underattended, you know, it'd be down about 30%. And it was sort of interesting to see that the parties weren't as lavish and the, you know, it costs a lot of money to take people over there and you know, also to look at the ranks of the journalists and see, you know, who didn't go and who, you know, how each, you know, there was really, everybody was down, you know, and across the board. And so I was just looking, you know, who went there and actually came out, you know, getting what they wanted out of it, you know, did it function? Did it work? And so I was struck by Disney, which of course opened up with Up and did very, very well. I thought, you know, giving those animators, you know, their due and, you know, treating them right and like auteurs, you know, proper Cannes Festival auteurs. And it played really well. And I thought they got some good coverage out of A Christmas Carol, too. They brought Jim Carrey and Bob Zemeckis to the Carlton and did a big snowy photo op. And so I was just running down the different people that sort of, you know, played well. And then the others where there were, you know, something like Agora, you know, didn't get what it was looking for in terms of a big sale in North America, just because you can't count on North America anymore to really come up with the dollars that people want. And you know, Dr. Parnassus, The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus, the Terry Gilliam film with Heath Ledger, didn't score either. It played okay at the end of the festival, but they didn't get the kind of money they were hoping out of North America. At least not yet.
Did you see the movie?
I actually missed that one because it was at the very end and I left before they screened it, and they didn't screen it early for press.
And I'm really curious to know actually how good that movie is, because it's going to get, I think, overshadowed a little bit because it was Heath Ledger's last movie.
Well, my sense from the people I spoke to and the reviews I read was that it was, you know, a perfectly good Terry Gilliam movie, and either you like those movies or you don't. You know, that doesn't mean it's commercial, but I like his movies, you know, so I'm curious to see it.
I left as well, so I didn't get to see it either. But your piece here on Cannes is quite interesting. It goes pretty in depth on, as to, as you said, who won, who lost, not on an award level, but you mentioned Bob Bernay, Sony Picture Classics, which I think they actually came out quite good this year.
Oh, they definitely did. I mean, they picked they picked the two winners of the festival. I mean, they're sort of uncanny. And the press, if you were to pick the, according to IndieWire poll that they did, and if you just looked at the reviews in Screen International, they always measure how the movies are being reviewed. Jacques Audiard's movie A Prophet, which came in second, and that was the best liked, best reviewed movie of the festival. So IFC wanted that one, but Sony Pictures Classics did get it, and they also got the Haneke film, The White Ribbon, which won the Palme d'Or, which I quite admired, but thought was, you know, it was 2.5 hours. It was long. Both of those films are 2.5 hours, but the Haneke was quite Bergman-like, you know, very dour, very unrelenting.
Oh.
It sort of hits you over the head.
Did you hear, or did you stay on top of what Roger Freeman was writing about how Isabelle Huppert basically bullied all of the other jurors into selecting that film as the Palme d'Or winner over A Prophet, which they had preferred? And do you buy that?
Well, I spoke to, I have my own sources, and I understand she was a very forceful, president of the jury, and she probably should have been a little clearer just in terms of how she presented her relationship to that movie, because of course she starred in one of his films, Haneke's films. I think it was The Piano Teacher, some years back. So she presumably had reasons for wanting to fight for that one. I understand that it was very close between the top two films, and that no selection was unanimous, and that was made very clear to me. But I don't know whether she ended up, you know, there was some reports of real fraction, you know, but I don't know if that's true or not. I know that the directors and the actors tended to split, and so there were certain films that the directors admired, like the Andrea Arnold and Thirst, and then there were other films that the actors admired, like Inglourious Basterds and Antichrist, which got the two acting prizes. So, and the women were the act, you know, the actors were women and the directors were men, so there was a kind of male female
Huh.
split as well.
Do you feel that those awards for Antichrist, I think one went to Charlotte Gainsbourg, the other went to, actually, I think it won just one. Just
It
Charlotte,
just won one.
yeah,
Yeah.
Charlotte Gainsbourg.
She I thought she totally deserved it. I mean, what's sort of interesting about Antichrist is that the actors gave it their all. And Lars von Trier is actually a very gifted director with a great deal of, you know, of skill. And so he's manipulating the audience very effectively. The question is whether the movie makes any sense, you know, or whether there's a real intellectual justification for a lot of what he does to the audience. I mean, the insert shots and the you know, extraordinary violence in it. I don't think he justifies it in the film, but the actors did fabulous work. I mean, they were both, Willem Dafoe was also very good.
Well,
Sperling, you didn't like this movie,
it's
right?
not that I didn't like it, and actually, it's funny you should mention that. As I have thought about it over the last several weeks, I realized I'm still thinking about it, which means
Yeah,
that
no, it doesn't go away.
it's successful in some way.
It's memorable and it's controversial and it got everybody riled up, and a lot of the highbrow critics are defending it. So he got what he wanted, which was a certain amount of attention, and he's back in the ranks of the working filmmakers. You know, he had been so depressed. So I'm happy for him on that level.
Well, one of the films you mentioned was Up, and it won the weekend this weekend with $68.2 million on over 3,700 screens. Night at the Museum 2, which was last weekend's top earner, made $25.5 million for a cumulative gross now of $105 million in its first 10 days, so not bad. The other new film opening this week was Drag Me to Hell, which was Sam Raimi's movie, also a film that appeared in Cannes. I didn't see it there. Did you see it, Anne?
I loved Drag Me to Hell, and I took my family out to Montclair, California last night to watch it at a drive-in.
Really?
Oh.
And it was a great time. A great time was had by all. That movie is so much fun to watch with a crowd. I mean, you just have, you know, people going, ah, you know, no, oh, no. You know, people, it's just very vocal and very participatory. And I think it's his best film. I think it's absolutely what Sam Raimi does best. And he just
Better than
delivers
Spider-Man?
it. I'm going to say it's better than Spider-Man. You know why? This is my own bias. It's who I am. I mean, I love Spider-Man too, and the second one not so much. But I actually, studio movies are part of an incredible process of collaboration. And to me, what's great about Drag Me to Hell is that it's Sam Raimi. It's him. It's who he is. It's very much what he does better than anyone. And so I'm handing it to him on this one.
It's
We'll
kind of
see
nice to
what
see him
happens.
go back to the roots.
Exactly. But it's not low budget by any means. I mean,
Unfortunately, I didn't get to see it in Cannes. I was just too busy. You always miss something in Cannes. Terminator Salvation, which I thought would be in Cannes this year, came in fourth place with $16.14 million, and it's earned
I don't know
$90 million.
anybody who says that's a good movie. Most people say skip it.
You know, if you're a Terminator fan, I mean, you should probably see it. But what's too bad about it is that it's even for me. I mean, I'm a big Terminator fan. I was lost a lot of the time. I didn't understand the timeline. You know, maybe I'm stupid, but you know, it was, and also Christian Bale is sort of miserable and unforgiving, and the great role though to see is Sam Worthington. I mean, this guy pops from the start. He's going to be in Avatar. Cameron found him first. He's Australian. He's another one of these rugged male Australian actors, you
I've been a
know.
fan since he did that movie called like Top Boots or something with Adam Garcia about guys who tap dance.
I had no idea. I'm going to have to rent
Oh, he's
this.
sexy in it. Yeah, you gotta find it. Wish I could remember
Yeah,
what it
I'm a
was called.
fan
It's
now.
about 10 years
I've
old.
gone over to the Worthington side.
Oh, I've been a fan for, 10 or 15 years. A long time. It's nice to see him get his due.
Well, I've certainly heard from three or four people the same thing, that it's really hard to follow and nobody can actually figure out what's going on, which is why supposedly, I don't want to give away the ending because I haven't seen it. I supposedly what happens at the end is one of the main characters kind of reviews the whole narrative of the film just to catch people up.
Well, I mean, the thing with Star Trek was that they somehow managed to pull you right in and get all the characters right and give you a rollicking good time, and you were never confused, and you knew exactly, even with this really complicated sort of, crazy timeline that they're working with, I was never lost, not for a
Oh,
moment.
I
And so
was.
that you were.
Yeah, I was. I had to, at the end of the movie, I saw it with a guy who, sort of knew his Trekisms. And I was like, yeah, I totally liked the film. I didn't understand the whole Spock future past tense thing. And he was like, Karen, that was the whole movie. I'm like, yeah, I didn't get it. So he had to explain it to me afterwards.
Well, but I think that I almost wonder. I mean, as much as I was saying, I'm not. You know, the studios do know how to do this kind of movie really well. And I think that if it had been supervised more carefully, I mean, it was this Moritz Bormann and these neophyte producers who got into a legal suit with Bormann. I mean, all this stuff. And then McGee,
Nope.
he was trying to prove that he could do action, and yet this movie has a very old-fashioned feeling, like it's from the past. It's not contemporary in some ways.
Now, McGee is the director for listeners who.
Yeah, I'm not sure he completely delivered here.
I don't think he delivered at all, and from what I understand, he didn't have a real good control over that set, which I think most people who listen to the Christian Bale rant kind of heard that, kind of understood that. But I don't think this is going to hurt his career, do you?
No, he can. He will move on. He got what he wanted out of this. I agree with you.
Well, Star Trek, you just mentioned, earned $12.8 million, come in fifth place, and
What's its total now?
$209.5 million.
See, I always maintained that that movie would chug along and keep earning, and because it's good. I mean, we have to believe that word of mouth counts for something, even in a competitive summer. It makes me happy.
Yeah, me too. For some reason, I don't begrudge J.J. Abrams' success.
Do you begrudge Tom Hanks' success? I guess a few people do because Angels and Demons, I think this is its third week. It dropped to sixth place, earning $11.2 million, and to date has earned $104.7 million. It doesn't seem like that's going to be a huge hit. Although, how could you not say it's a huge hit? It earned over $104 million.
I've
That's not
never
so
been a Tom
much.
Hanks fan.
That's not so much. He did as good a job as anybody could do in that movie. Which is actually better than the first one. This is one of those weird phenomena where the movie that it's following did an incredible amount of business all over the world, but on some level it wasn't that good. So
Yeah.
now they don't want to see the second one, and they didn't manage to make the second one that much more interesting. So there it is.
And you know, I don't know what's happened to Tom Hanks's career. There was actually an article in the LA Times this morning about this very thing. You know, what happened to Tom Hanks? We used to like him so much, and now he's like making boring choices.
That's the answer.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the problem with people who are trying. I mean, it's the Harrison Ford problem. It's the Tom. I mean, Tom Cruise is actually in a better place in a funny way because he's already been liberated from the, you know, I have to be a movie star, you know, who makes 20, who earns and justifies $20 million a picture. I don't have to do that. Cruise is, he can go do good movies if he wants to. I mean, Hanks is still hanging on for dear life to the star thing, and that's sometimes the worst thing that these people can do.
Yeah.
Another group that's had a good run, not a star, not a movie star, is Pixar, because Up came in first place, and it's their 10th film to open huge. And this film, like Star Trek, will probably have legs and continue to earn.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier, Anne, about being happy to see animators being treated like proper auteurs. I'm not sure I entirely agree with that. I personally hate animated films. Hate them. I will never see this movie.
I'm sorry to hear that, Karen.
Hey, you're talking to somebody who hated WALL-E, okay? I hated WALL-E.
Oh dear.
Yeah, I kind of forgot to mention that Karen is our resident contrarian.
It's okay. I mean, I guess Armin White has been attacking the Pixar thing. I was listening with great interest to the press conference at Cannes, and I was I can't get enough of John Lasseter because I think that 10 for 10, you know, they have made the best written, the best acted. I mean, I'm a big proponent of taking animators seriously as actors, that acting is acting, even if it's not done by you know, entirely by live, you know, living, breathing actors. Of course, they do the
Oh,
voices,
I
and
agree.
it's
I think
very
it's
important.
harder actually to act that way.
Yeah. So I'm a huge fan of the Pixar Combine, and I think that it, you know, movie for movie, they do what everybody in Hollywood should do, and that is try to make the highest quality films that they possibly can every single time.
Well, Kenneth Turan wrote the movie A Love Letter on Friday in the Los Angeles Times. That review was beyond glowing. And Karen, I hate to say this, but if you're not a fan of animated movies, then you're out of luck because DreamWorks plans on releasing five films. Now, this is DreamWorks Animation, five films every 2 years. So they're upping the number of films they do each year, I think by two.
Yeah, I'm not going to see any of those.
Well, you know, Karen, you're not alone. I mean, there are a lot of people, and a lot of them are members of the Academy. I mean, I'm also someone who keeps railing against the fact that the animated films are relegated to this animated ghetto, and that they should be in there with the rest of the big boys. But I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. Do you look at the performance capture movies as the same thing? I mean, do
Yeah.
they bother you too?
Yeah.
Yeah.
To me, they belong in the cartoon category. And I think John Lasseter is extremely talented. I think Pixar is fantastic. I just think that is one way of movie making. And I don't think that cartoons, yeah, I know animated movies, cartoons, should be in with regular movies that involve all kinds of things like crews and, you know, grips. And to me, it's a completely different way of making movies. Not necessarily worse, but totally different. And I just
Well,
happen to hate them.
the truth of the matter, though, is that a lot of the movies that are made today, especially the big tentpole movies that use a lot of visual effects, those visual effects are computer graphics, and they're exactly the same technology that's used to make animated films. And more films today are dominated by by those effects. And so if you like, for example, I'm not saying you like it, but if you were to admire the work in Superman or Returns or the work in Spider-Man, these are, a lot of that stuff is the
Yeah, I
same
hate all that too.
technology. Yeah.
Hate all that too.
Yeah, you are a contrarian.
I like people. I like watching people, not cartoons. I appreciate good talent. I do. And I know that I'm wrong. I just happen to hate it.
Well, I guess then you won't be seeing How to Train Your Dragon, which opens March 26, 2010. And then through 2012, DreamWorks Animation has eight films that they're releasing, including a sequel to Madagascar, which is slated for May 25th, 2012. Puss in Boots, which I think is an offshoot of or a spin-off of Shrek.
Correct.
And of course, the fourth Shrek, if there haven't been four already, Shrek Forever After is due out May 21st, 2010. And a sequel to Kung Fu Panda is due out in June of 2011. So they have a lot of sequels.
Yeah. Let
Yeah, that
me
sound
just
you hear is
say.
me banging my head against the desk.
No, I'm not going to go see all that. I never saw any of the Madagascar films, and I did like Kung Fu Panda, but I'm picky about my animation, I'll say that.
Okay, good. The
Another film that's got a sequel in the works is The Hangover, which has been receiving a lot of buzz this week,
it's got
starting
a
with an
sequel
LA
planned and it
Times.
hasn't even been released yet.
Have you seen a screening yet?
I have seen a screening. I went last night to see the last screening that's being held here in Los Angeles.
Well, they didn't invite me.
I had to call them and ask them if they were holding any screenings. Were you in show? You were at Show West, as was I. Did you see the Warner Brothers presentation, which had the trailer and clips of this film in it?
I saw the trailer early on, and as soon as I saw the trailer, I was like, okay, this is a huge hit. There was no question in my mind. I'm like rolling my eyes initially, and then I realize I want to see too. I want to find out what those guys did. The mystery is there. I gotta know.
I think it looks hysterical, and I love Brad Cooper. Love him.
Well, it's the film is about four guys: Bradley Cooper, as you just mentioned, Karen, Ed Helms from The Daily Show, Justin Bartha, and Zach Galifianakis, and they head to Las Vegas for a bachelor party, and one of them is getting married. I'm not quite sure who it is. I want to say it's Justin Bartha,
Justin Bartha is the one getting married.
and
And they
they.
have this crazy night, and they wake up, and Justin is gone. And the guys they have to retrace their steps. So they find like a baby and a tiger in the room, and all kinds of things that don't make any sense whatsoever. And they have to go back and retrace their steps and find out what happened.
Yeah,
Find them.
I mean, they wake up, and that's what's in the trailer. They wake up in a hotel suite in Las Vegas that is completely trashed. And it gets even crazier from there. From the tiger in the bathtub, there's a chicken running around the hotel room.
You can't leave a baby here. We've got a tiger in the
I mean, that trailer, I will agree with you. And when I saw that, I mean, Show West, you're sitting around with a whole bunch of movie theater owners. Nobody had heard about this film, really. It wasn't a very high-profile film. And when that trailer was shown, everybody responded. And like you, I said, this film is going to be a huge hit, and nobody's going to see it coming. At least nobody outside the industry is going to see it coming. And it's going to be a huge sleeper hit like 40-Year-Old Virgin or the like. All those films that are comedies that come out of nowhere, they're somewhat raunchy in some regard. It is a very raunchy film.
Looking forward.
And filled with profane language. I don't know how that film got rated. What I find interesting, though, is the way they're promoting the film is the same way they promoted Paul Blart: Mall Cop. What is the name of the actor in Paul Blart: Mall Cop that I am now completely forgetting?
I don't know it either.
The King of Queens guy.
Yeah, Kevin.
Well, they
Kevin,
took
the King of Queens guy, yeah.
Him around to a number of cities where he actually did personal appearances to promote the film, and they're doing the same thing with The Hangover. And they started on May 18th, and they are screening it in 80 cities, and the cast is going to Denver, Atlanta, Phoenix, Philadelphia, and Miami to help promote the film at special screenings. So they're really trying to get the word of mouth out on that, and I don't think they're going to have a hard time. as I mentioned, they already Warner Brothers already has a sequel in the works. I would assume that that would
Indicate that they're really happy about it.
And it's the other thing is that they don't have any stars in it, so it's incredibly cheap and they're going to make a fortune.
Yep.
So of course they want more.
Good point. I didn't think of it that way. But they don't, here's the thing, they don't have any deals with any of the actors in place
Oh, then
already.
they will have to cough up a few bucks.
Yeah.
That's right. So if it does do incredibly well, then they're going to have to, as you say, cough up their wallets.
But I mean, you wouldn't think initially that this would be the type of movie that would, invite a sequel. It really seems like a one-off.
Well, you never
Haven't
know.
seen it yet.
So did Weekend at Bernie's, but they made a sequel to that.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Now, another film that is going through similar marketing machinations is A Christmas Carol, which, and you mentioned earlier, it's the Robert Zemeckis film based on the Dickens novel that Jim Carrey stars in. It's an animated film done with motion capture as
Your
Zemeckis's.
favorite.
But what's interesting about this is that it's on a 6-month train tour starting here in Los Angeles last weekend. It's going to 40 cities, and they have, and we covered this on Celluloid Junkie as well. It's being taken to all of these cities by train, and they are showing the film or clips of the film in a blow-up movie theater. It's an inflatable movie theater, which I kind of found interesting.
Yeah, what I find interesting is that everybody had to wait like 3 hours to get on the train.
Well, that's where I was headed.
Whee! That sounds like so much fun.
Well, it was more than 3 hours at some points. A friend of mine went down to Union Station in Los Angeles, where the blow-up or inflatable movie theater was set up, and he was told that it would be a 5-hour wait from where he was standing.
Did he stay?
No, he left.
Yeah. Okay, good.
Well, it's a sign that, the old-fashioned whistle-stop tour, actually can be useful. I mean, they can go from city to city and make a fuss about a movie that would ordinarily just be a big blast of advertising. I don't know why they feel the need to do it exactly. That's the only question I have, because they've got a Jim Carrey movie. It indicates to me they may feel a slight need to push this more than the presence of Jim Carrey alone would
But it's
warrant. In other words, maybe
animated,
he's
so
not a
it's.
big star as anymore, is my question.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm going to agree with. I really don't think he is. I think that it all depends on what he's in. And given that this is an animated movie, you technically don't have a Jim Carrey movie. I mean, he voices it, but it's not quite the same. It's sort of like, Lemony Snicket in a series of unfortunate events where he was so unrecognizable that it almost made it not a Jim Carrey movie.
Indeed, you're right. Yep, I think you're probably right because he's had a pretty checkered. I mean, one of his films was at Cannes, I Love You, Philip Morris, in the fortnight, which had been a Sundance film that, didn't sell to a big distributor after Sundance, and it's basically being self-distributed at this point. So that's not the Jim Carrey that we all expect. And I was a little disappointed in that film. Did you see it, Spurley?
Yes, I did, and as I mentioned last week, I was a little disappointed in that film as well. I felt that it had all of the makings of a really good film. It's a real crowd pleaser. It's got some wonderful moments in it, and it's really funny at times, and the characters are really well constructed, but there was just no chemistry between Jim Carrey and Ewan McGregor, who play the two leads.
I prefer Hump Day myself.
You know, that's a film I have not seen. Hump Day
Oh,
was.
it's wonderful. It's wonderful. The premise of the movie is that these two old buddies from college reunite, and one of them has been sort of schlepping around South America, and the other one's like a straight married guy. And they go out one night and they get really wasted and they commit to co-starring in a porn film with each other. And then they get macho about it and they're not going to back down. And it's just the funniest movie, and it's very well acted. It's sort of a mumblecore movie, very low budget indie kind of handheld thing, but very good acting.
Well, that was picked up at Sundance, and it was both, it appeared in Sundance and in Cannes, so it's
Yeah.
got really good word of mouth. Now, Anne, did you go to the press conference that Carrie held in Cannes?
I was at the Antichrist press conference.
Ah,
It was
okay.
at exactly the same time, and I think I made the right choice.
Well, I went to both the Antichrist press conference and the
You did
A
both.
Christmas
I'm
Carol.
impressed.
Well, A Christmas Carol, as usual, when a big star and big film and big director are there doing a press conference off the festival circuit or off the festival agenda, it's usually late, and that's exactly what happened here. I actually have a clip from that press conference of Jim Carrey explaining why it is they made the film and why it is they're redoing A Christmas Carol, even though it's been done 1,000 times.
However you tell a story is all right. Some stories are told with puppets. Some stories are told with illustrations. Some stories are told by a book. You know, there is no limit. And the wonderful thing about films like this is like the left and right hemispheres coming together in an explosion of some sort. And you don't necessarily need to know where it's going or why you didn't do it another way. Of course it can be done another way. It's been done another way. This is what makes it different, is it's being done in a completely different way than it's ever been done before. It's being done in you're seeing this story, a very old story, a wonderful story told in a completely new way. And I love it. I celebrate that. And you can't question it. You can't say, well, what's going to be the significance of this technology? Because we don't know yet. I mean, that you just, people like Bob just go down the road. They just go down that alley and they go, to heck with, assurances. I don't know where this is going. He's devoted the last, I don't know, 20 years of your life to developing this technology. Or, it's an incredible thing to dedicate yourself and say, I don't know where it's going, but it's going to be an amazing journey. And this is part of the journey.
I look forward to the movie, actually. Although the Zemeckis style of animation, the motion capture animation, still leaves me slightly cold. I like it when it's more stylized, like Monster House, than this. When it gets too close and too realistic, it sort of creeps me out. But I'll be cautiously.
The footage they showed in Cannes, I'll tell you, there were moments there where I couldn't figure out what was real and what wasn't. And of course, nothing is real, but they've gotten it to the point where it really looks like real life. It doesn't look animated at all, at least in certain parts.
Should actors be worried for their jobs?
Well, the question of what people do now, to fix. I mean, I find myself sometimes looking at certain actors in certain movies and going, they look really good here. You
What
know, I
about
think a lot of that is going on now, more than
well,
we
what about
think.
the fact that Arnold was in the Terminator, just a digital version of him?
Exactly.
It's
We
really
didn't
rather
talk,
frightening.
though, really. Yeah. No, it worked. You can do it if it's a short bit. I mean, Avatar is going to be the big test. That'll be fascinating, the Cameron movie. Can't wait.
Yeah, no, me either. But when you say that you're thinking, oh, they look really good, you mean that they've been sort of like digitally enhanced?
Exactly.
Oh, I love that.
Well, think about it. In Benjamin Button, right?
Right.
The Brad Pitt character ages up, ages down, whatever, and so does Cate Blanchett's character, and they admit that there are sequences in there where she is made to look a lot younger than she is, and he is made to look a lot younger than he is, and then he sort of gets to where he really is, and then he gets younger. You see what I mean? I mean,
Yeah.
it really is interesting. That's they do that with special effects, visual effects. And so they're doing that a lot too. That would be, I should look into this.
Yeah. I wonder if they can do it just around me, like during the day.
That would help. Well, they don't have to do facelifts anymore. That's the point. I mean, in real life, they don't have to mess around anymore because it's going to be done for them.
Well, another story, another big entertainment news story that was being bantered about this week was that of the AT&T American Idol kerfuffle. And I don't want to spend a lot of time on this because we talked about it ad nauseum. And I know, Karen, it's your favorite topic, but I can say I don't watch the show. And you said you don't watch the show before we started recording. So I don't want to spend a lot of time on it, but.
Well, okay, I'll tell you what happened. The fact is that some AT&T employees went to a party that was for, I think it was in actual Arkansas where Chris Allen was from, and it was basically a party of, Chris Allen fans, and they handed out special phones or something, and taught them how to send big blocks of texts. And therefore, they were sending big blocks of votes, you know, of texts to vote for Chris Allen. And there's this big brouhaha because it's like, oh, well, did it affect, you know, the ultimate tally? And, you know, should Adam really have won, et cetera? And everyone, including Adam Lambert, is saying, no, this didn't affect it at all. And so essentially, it's kind of a non-story, especially since I have heard that it wasn't even close, the results, that Chris won by a landslide. And Adam doesn't seem to care, so it's really sort of a non-story. But nevertheless...
They should be careful about that sort of thing. I think it looks bad.
It does look bad. It looks careless, which is really what I think makes them look so bad. It's just, you can tell that nobody thought how stupid that would be to do that.
And we should say that Chris Allen and Adam Lambert are the two semifinalists that made it.
Of American Idol.
Chris Allen won. Adam Lambert did not. And 100 million votes were cast for the final. And an AT&T spokesperson said a small number of devices, without offering specifics, were handed out. And users were coached on how to text 100 votes at a time, which would add up to only 100,000 votes.
100? I thought it was 10. 100?
100,000 votes, or less than 0.1% of the votes cast. So what they're trying to say is, yeah, okay, this might have happened, but it didn't affect it. Right.
Mm-hmm.
What certainly affected the press continuing to write about it was, I guess, Clay Aiken said something about Adam Lambert, the contestant who did not win. And Clay Aiken is the runner-up from season 2 or 3 of American Idol, who's gone on to have a fine recording career.
Yeah, you mock him. He actually hasn't done too badly on Broadway. But yeah, he and his blog or his MySpace page or something kind of dissed Adam, saying that he made his ears bleed, which, you know, okay, I mean, yeah, Adam screeched a little bit. But come on, Clay. Adam's so much more talented. Clay was just looking for press.
Well,
kind of classless, if you ask me. But Adam then told Access Hollywood, you know, I don't know Clay, but I'm glad he's getting headlined now, though, because he wasn't before. If he wants to ride my coattails about it, good for him.
That's what Adam Lambert said.
Right, which is really funny because Adam's done nothing but prove to be a pretty classy guy throughout this entire thing. So I think it's really pretty funny.
Well, one of our listeners sent in an email. It's our very first listener email that normally we'll do this at the end of each episode, but since it applies here, we'll read it. Dario Canigo, he writes, "Hey guys, good work on the site. I stumbled across it by accident, but I have it bookmarked now." That's good to know. He said he just wants to make a quick comment about your latest posting regarding American Idol. After watching the show all season, I had a great hope and little doubt that in the end, Chris Allen would beat out Adam Lambert to become America's latest idol. Allen appears to be an artist, whereas Lambert is little more than a screechy B-list wannabe lounge act, which I'm sure, Karen, you really appreciate him saying. Perhaps Lambert's performances were better in person and just did not translate to television. That is the only way I can begin to understand the judge's fascination with this singer who, although admittedly has a great range in his voice, nevertheless sounds more like an extra from the Rocky Horror Picture Show than an American Idol.
Ah!
And he goes on to talk about how it was clear the judges favored Lambert, but ultimately, however, the American public was not fooled by the poor man's meatloaf and chose to reward an artist who not only sings, but is musically talented. I hope Queen does not ruin their legacy and the memory of a truly magnificent singer in Freddie Mercury by choosing Lambert to front what was a once great band. Then again, the almighty dollar makes us all do things that a few years from now will have us saying, what were we thinking? Mr. Taylor Hicks, anyone? Keep up the good work, Dark. So that's...
Okay, dear Dario.
I knew that would just get you going, so
I was... Actually, it kind of made me think, really?
Well, something
But I still think he's wrong.
Well, something I find way more interesting than American Idol is a show we're not even able to watch here in the United States, which is...
Except on YouTube,
which is that of Britain's Got Talent and the story of Susan Boyle. Earlier in the week, Susan Boyle is I don't know, what would you call her? She's a singer, but she's...
Okay, she's from a little town in Scotland or Ireland? I think it's Scotland.
Scotland.
Who... came out of nowhere, and she was this frumpy woman, and she came on to audition for Britain's Got Talent and just wowed everybody.
And she wowed everybody after she stepped out on stage and didn't necessarily look like a rock star.
And everybody was expecting her to be a complete loser, and they were all already making fun of her, even in the audience, in advance. And then she opened her mouth and sang beautifully from Les Mis. And then, you know, everybody started talking about making her over, and she got her brows done.
And her hair done. And...
Yeah, but she still looks like herself, I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah, she does. And that happened in early April. And it took until, well, the end of May for Britain's Got Talent to hold their finals. And so since, I think it was April 7th or 9th, until this past Saturday, May 30th, she has been in the press constantly. She even appeared on the Oprah Winfrey Show. And I guess eventually all of that press and all of that attention got to her because there were reports earlier in the week from the UK that she was cracking under the pressure, as we all probably would. And the headline in the Daily Mail read, "Susan Boyle involved in two furious foul-mouthed outbursts." Apparently she was watching the show after she appeared on the semifinals, and Pierce Morgan, one of the judges on the show, told another singer that she had performed exceptionally well. In fact, it was the best performance she had seen. It was the best performance he had seen during the semifinals. And the paper reports, watching the show at the hotel's bar, Boyle is accused of sticking two fingers up at a television and shouting F off before stomping off to her room after she heard Pierce Morgan's review of a competitor.
But you kind of have to wonder if she just sort of said that, you know, tongue in cheek. You know what I mean? Like, bugger off. Do you know what I mean? Like, as opposed to the way they wrote it here, making it sound like she had a temper tantrum.
Yeah, they weren't.
Yeah, it's hard to know.
They weren't particularly kind to her. But the tabloids never are over there, and the newspapers never seem to be.
They build you up and then they take you down. But she's under tremendous pressure. Absolutely.
And she almost quit.
Yes, that
which maybe she should have, seeing as she didn't win.
Well, that's right. She did not win. So last night in the UK, the finals were held, and she did not win. Instead, a dance troupe, a group of street dancers, no less, named Diversity won. Now, have you seen the YouTube, clips of them?
No.
They're actually quite good, but I also think they were shot incredibly well, because if you are looking at them head on, they are one of those groups where lots of dancers are actually behind the main dancer, and so their arms are coming out and their legs are coming out, and so it looks like that one person has more arms and legs. But if you're off to the side, of course, you'll be able to see everybody stacked up behind them, behind that main dancer. But they were incredibly vibrant and really energetic, and I think that people just kind of got a little sick of the whole Susan Boyle of it all, and they voted for this dance troupe Diversity.
Which is really unfortunate for her.
And Susan Boyle will continue to get some attention and presumably some kind of career, right?
Well, actually, it's funny you should say that, because the New York Times writes, "Winners of the Britain's Got Talent, one of a host of talent shows that are among the most watched television programs in Britain, receive about $160,000 and a spot on the roster of the Royal Variety Performance presented in front of the Queen. Their high profiles also virtually assure that they will have a lucrative career in show business." I don't know how lucrative a career you can have as a street dancer, but they go on to say, "But the same is often true of the runners-up, who in this case include Julian Smith, a soulful saxophonist who was a darling of the studio audience and came in third. And the exposure Ms. Boyle has received since her original audition, culminating in an appearance on Oprah in the United States, means she is a hot property who is virtually guaranteed a recording contract." So I agree with you, Anne. I think that most definitely she will go on to have a recording contract. She'll probably star in a Broadway show at some point, if she can act at all. And she'll probably just continue touring.
She seems a little old to be wanting to tour. And what I find really sort of disingenuous is the fact that she says that she can't handle all the pressure about being famous, and yet she's appearing on Oprah. I mean, come on, really? Okay, silence. That meant was silence. I think Susan Boyle.
Well, no, I don't disagree with you. I mean, she's playing both ends, but I bet she ends up being someone that has some kind of profile. I just have this instinct that she'll be in the UK. I don't see her over here somehow.
No, I don't either. I don't
see her on Broadway either.
No, she's too old for it. I think that she'll cut an album, which will probably do really well, but she would never make it here. I don't think she could handle it.
Yeah.
Frankly, I don't find her particularly interesting. I love her voice. I mean, it makes me cry like whenever I hear her sing, but I don't find her particularly interesting.
I knew who Susan Boyle was, certainly because of YouTube and the 70 million views and the Oprah Winfrey show, but I had no idea who Kate Gosselin was. And I was in the San Francisco airport or the Oakland airport last week, and I happened to be at the newsstand, and I see all of these magazines with this Kate Gosselin on the front cover. And I had no idea who she was, and I turned to the person behind me in line and said, "Who is this Kate Gosselin?" And they said, "Well, I think she's on some reality TV show." And I thought, well, it must be a reality TV show in Britain because I've never heard of this person. And now, this week, of course, you can't turn around without hearing her name. And I've never seen this TV show that she's on.
Well, basically, as soon as it was understood that she and her husband were having marital problems and that there might have been an affair, then everybody started watching the show, and the ratings went through the roof, and it's become this enormous, spinning thing that just keeps growing, and everybody's paying attention to it now. And it's so typical, so completely American, that we would all go, oh, they're not really, he's having an affair. We got to watch, It's so like a train wreck.
Now, what is the show about?
I've never seen it.
Oh, it's about John and Kate, and they're married, and they have twin girls, and then they did in vitro, and they ended up with six. They've got eight kids.
And what network is it on?
TLC, the Learning Channel.
And what's the name of the show?
John and Kate Plus Eight.
John and Kate, right?
John and Kate Plus Eight. Okay.
John and Kate Plus Eight. And originally, and I actually watched this show because I was over at someone's house like about a year and a half ago, and I watched it. It's the only time I've ever seen it. And they just kind of followed this family and how they were raising eight kids. And Susan is criticized for belittling John. And she definitely does that. She treats her husband with absolutely no respect, which I think a lot of people found really pretty interesting. But he's also sort of a loser, although he's a great dad, but he's sort of a nothing. But then, I mean, TLC kind of, I don't know, I wonder whether TLC is behind this. And that, if it's true, really sort of disgusts me. Because, sort of out of nowhere, all of a sudden we cared whether this guy who, none of us watched the show, all of a sudden we cared that he might have had an affair. It's like, huh?
I still don't care.
Oh, I don't care either.
And I wouldn't be shocked.
It's just absolutely reveals the nature of the collective beast that we're all part of. That's all.
That we help create.
You'd rather watch a train wreck than a happy family.
And I'm the first person to admit that I would love to watch a train wreck. I'm completely, I love that.
Well, actually, I'm going to come back to that in just a moment because I'm going to put a pin in that thought because by far the biggest news story of the week was Jay Leno and the last Tonight Show that he will be hosting was held on Friday. Did you guys watch that?
No.
I don't care about Jay Leno at all.
I love Jay Leno, and I watch him a lot, but honestly, he's going to keep doing the show at 10 o'clock. I mean, I don't feel this great sense of loss. I mean, he's going to come back. I'm not worried about it. I think it's very smart that they're taking him away for a while so that Conan has a chance to build the 11 o'clock audience up, because I have a feeling if they did it right away, everybody would just go back to everybody who watches Leno would watch Leno. And so I wonder about that, if people are going to watch both shows is a good question to me. I would imagine that Leno is going to come out ahead on this one.
I would agree with you. And I think when Leno started The Tonight Show, of course, he took over for Johnny Carson, who was the host of The Tonight Show before him for, I think, 20 some odd years. But Leno started when there was no such thing as a DVR. Now that there are such things as a digital video recorder, you start your recording at 8 o'clock. You come home, and as I mentioned last week, you cook dinner, you put the kids to bed, you do everything you need to do at home, and then at around 9, 9:30, you sit down and you start watching television. Well, it's about 10:30 before you catch up with it. And at that point, you don't want to get involved in an hour-long program or another program. However, when you turn off the DVR, there's the end of Jay Leno that you can watch. And you don't have to stay up until midnight or 12:30 in the morning to get your variety show in. You can do it at 10 o'clock at night.
I think he will be favored in this regard. And the sad thing, the really sad thing, is how many people are not being employed as a result of this, you know, this desperation move on the part of NBC. I think it's really too bad. It's how many half hour long shows didn't get made or won't get made because of it.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Actually, we did the math on that, didn't we? We, at least writer wise, we did the math, and it was like, I think 60 writers alone won't be employed.
You think he's going to get hurt by this?
No, I don't think he's going to. I don't think he's going to get hurt by it at all. I think he's going to be fine.
Can I be the contrarian? I'm going to say that Jay Leno is going to completely bomb in this hour.
That's your prediction?
I really do. I don't think enough people have DVRs for Sperling's theory to be valid, and I think that people watch Jay Leno as they're drifting off to sleep. I think that people tend to, it doesn't pass the mom test. My mother doesn't get in and watch TV until like 9 o'clock or 10. And then she likes to watch her hour-long dramas. She's not going to watch Jay Leno.
Isn't she going to watch the best thing on at that hour?
No. No. I think you're talking like a critic right now. No.
That's very interesting you should say that. because that's our next story.
It's very interesting. I made a segue and I didn't try.
Yes. Well, before we segue off, did any of you watch, what was his name? So I take it none of you saw Mel Gibson on Leno earlier in the week.
No,
I can't stand him.
I found it very interesting that he came out and Jay Leno, I don't want to say harassed him because it was all in good fun, so to speak, but he definitely got a little personal and asked him about Mel Gibson's divorce and that he's going back to acting instead of directing, and asked him about his new girlfriend and
making her pregnant, right?
Making
That's
her
disgusting.
Yes, and the fact that she's pregnant, and so they definitely had, and he, I guess, confirmed that she was pregnant on that show, and they're saying it was another moment like the Hugh Grant moment where he said, you know, to Hugh Grant, the actor, after he was arrested for propositioning soliciting a
being
prostitute,
caught with a hooker in a compromising position.
Yeah.
Just divine.
the press on it has been that it was one of those moments. Instead of saying, "What were you?
What the hell were you thinking?"
He said, "What happened?" I think is what he said. And Mel Gibson then went and proceeded to talk about his divorce, which was a little uncomfortable, I think, as a viewer. What Leno did do that was very nice on his last show, he said, "Please give Conan as much support as you've given me throughout the years," as he was kind of closing out the show. But the last segment he did, he talked about the trombone player in the band that has been with the band for 17 years, and that the third week of the show, that trombone player had a child. And they had the trombone player on the show, and they had a picture of the baby that was 3 days old. And then they brought the three-day-old baby out. Of course, she's now 17. And
I bet that had an impact.
Just wait, because what wound up happening was he was standing in front of this curtain with her, and he started to talk about all of the people who had met on the show. One stage manager marries another stage manager, two writers got married, and he went and he kind of very quickly rehashed just some of the relationships that started because people worked on the show. And it got him thinking or wondering how many people have been born, how many babies were born based on relationships that started because people worked on the show. And they started tabulating it. And of course, the curtain raises, 68 children, and they were all standing behind the curtain.
I would have completely lost it if I was watching.
It was a very touching moment.
Me too.
It was a great, great television moment. It was really nice. But, and, you know, sorry, Karen, I know I ruined your segue earlier, but the segue, of course, was to the fact that the very last guest on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno was Conan O'Brien, who is taking over the hosting job.
Oh, and, that's nice.
And Brian Lowry had a piece in Variety about whether there is a disconnect between critical adulation and popular success. Which I think, Anne, you touched on, and Karen, you touched on.
Well, the whole question right now is whether people pay attention to critics. And I'm going to argue that they do. Even young people pay attention. It's just a question of how it's being delivered and how it's being found, you know, and what form it takes. And I don't think that it's all over. The disconnect you're talking about, it has always existed, I think. It's grown-ups. Adults, you know, people who pay attention to quality, critics can have an impact on them. Otherwise, they have no impact.
Well, if they didn't have an impact, then Rotten Tomatoes wouldn't be such a huge site, would it? Nobody would care what critics thought. But instead,
that's different. That's about consensus. That's about aggregation. That's about saying, oh, Up. By the way, Karen, I believe that the number on Up on Rotten Tomatoes is 98%.
So you stand in the 2 percentile. How does that make you feel, Karen? You're in the 2 percentile.
No, that's not true. The critics who do this for a living, you know, they ended up at 98%. That doesn't mean that they reflect what the audience thinks.
But, exactly.
Yeah. Well, Brian Lowry's article is quite interesting, and he writes here, this dynamic has bedeviled not merely critics, but industry organizations such as those responsible for doling out the Oscars and Emmys. They've been left wondering if viewers will still sit through award shows that heap praise upon projects with which they're utterly unfamiliar, other than to see who wore what.
Well, that's a question of when, you know, I pay attention to the Oscars. I mean, when the Oscars choose not to reward the movies like Lord of the Rings, you know, that are also hugely popular, or Titanic, or Braveheart. I mean, when they go the other way, that's what ends up happening. But they have to do what they have to do. I still love the Oscars, and I still, you know, so do many, many people around the world. And it's absurd to sort of, you know, tisk tisk and say to the Academy that they should do something different than what they do, that they should vote some other way from what they care about. Of course they're going to vote what they care about, and they should. And I, you know, you can argue till the cows come home about how they should fix the show or change the show or change the way they do things, but it is what it is, and it's fine. I don't think it's broken. I think that the ratings aren't going to be as good when they choose the art films, and that's when they don't go with the popular films. That's all it is. Sometimes they do, and sometimes they don't.
Well, do you
agree? End of rant.
That's okay. No, hey, rants are great.
You like rants.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what the show is all about, especially with Karen around. There's always a rant right around the corner. Now, do you agree with Brian Lowry that Conan might be too good to be popular? Do you think Conan will do a decent job on hosting The Tonight Show?
Well, I mean, Conan is fine. I like him, and I think he probably needs a new challenge. He probably needs to step up to a new, wider, you know, different audience. I'll be very curious to see what he does with it. He's a capable guy. I'm probably the slightly older demo that feels comfortable with Letterman and Leno, frankly. I don't know. I don't watch Conan that much because there's only so many places I'll be able to watch. I'm the one who watches Charlie Rose.
Hey, I love Charlie Rose. I think he's a really...
Still on?
Yes, he's really a great interviewer, and his show is very engaging. I really enjoy
it. And I watch Oprah, believe it or not. But I TiVo
them. I watch Oprah.
You know, I TiVo them, and then I kill the ones I don't want to watch, and, you know, whatever.
I watch Jon Stewart. I love Rachel Maddow.
Exactly. Those are the shows I like, too.
What I found interesting was on that last show there, when he had Conan out on as a guest, Leno cut to the day that it was announced that Conan O'Brien was going to be replacing David Letterman on Late Night. Of course, Letterman was moving over to CBS to host his Late Night show. What was interesting there was that Conan O'Brien had been told 8 hours earlier, while sitting in a writing room where he was working on The Simpsons, that he had been selected. And he was requested to please get in a car that was being sent for him so that he could be driven over to NBC, sign his contract, and appear on The Jay Leno Show, or The Tonight Show with Jay Leno. And they cut to the clip of Leno introducing him, and he walks out wearing jeans and a tie, and he looked like a deer caught in headlights. And so I agree.
I remember that.
I do too.
I agree with you, and I do think that, you know, he's over that at this point. He's pretty much a veteran after 16, 17 years. He does need a new challenge, and certainly being on at 11:30 and getting a wider audience will be interesting to see how he does. I'm sure he'll do fine.
You know, he's a little edgier than Jay, which is why I've always liked him. And I think that people of, you know, a generation below me, that's what they want. That's why Jon Stewart is, you know, so loved.
Look, on election night, you know, I was watching with a bunch of different people. We were watching CNN and MSNBC. We were, you know, even looking at Fox News just to be contrarian, and we were, you know, shifting around. My daughter called, and she was watching the whole thing on Jon Stewart.
Yep.
Actually, so I don't know whether I should admit this, but I watched most of it on Jon Stewart, too, but I did flip back and forth.
Thinking like a 20-year-old.
Yes.
No, I think that if Jon Stewart was on NBC at 10 o'clock, I think he would do really well.
Well, of course, all of our overseas listeners are thinking, who are all these people? Except for Jon Stewart, they probably have no interest.
I'm sure they know who Jay Leno is.
Yeah, that's probably true. Now, you don't watch Conan, Anne, but would you watch a show based on Twitter? Because last week we reported that Twitter was going to be spun into a television show, or there were plans to try and base a television show around Twitter.
That is such a recipe for a disaster, I cannot tell you. I mean, in my experience, you can adapt a book where there's a story. You can adapt a lot of things. There's got to be a story there. And until there's a good story, I will be very, very, skeptical.
But from what I understand, it's going to be a reality show that is going to be having Twitter followers try and find celebrities.
Right, which got Ashton Kutcher to say that he might actually have to sign off of Twitter. Now, of course, Ashton Kutcher, the actor, is one of the reasons Twitter is so popular, because he was in this huge race with CNN headline news or breaking news to get a million followers on Twitter. And he, I think, won. And
he won.
He wrote on his Twitter account, where he posted on Twitter, "Wow, I hope this isn't true. I really don't like being sold out. May have to take a Twitter hiatus."
So yeah, right. Ashton, you wouldn't exist if there wasn't Twitter.
Now, I'm fascinated by the way that these celebrities want attention. You know, I grew up in an era where Pat Kingsley was the PR doyen, and her whole approach was to say no, you know, to make them mysterious, to withhold them, to only let them do certain things. And now I find this, you know, John Favreau is very good on Twitter, and there are a number of them who play it very well and know how to get attention and get their set pictures up. And, you know, Rob Luketic is, you know, on the set of the movie he's shooting with Kutcher, and he's Twittering as well. You know, everybody wants more attention. And what happens is that you start finding them less interesting, I find.
That's funny that you say that, though, because I think a lot of people, at least for a lot of people, it's the exact opposite, that you aren't anybody unless somebody's Twittering about you, or you've got a million followers on Twitter, or, you know, you have 60,000 people that will respond to your blog posts at the drop of a hat. And that's...
It may be that Kutcher knows something that the rest of us don't. In other words, you know, part of the problem with stardom right now is that it doesn't seem to function anymore. You know, stardom is ephemeral, and there's so many distractions out there that maybe the only way to get people to you know, pay attention to you is just to be ubiquitous. I think that he may know something the rest of us don't.
Yeah, I mean, I mock him, but he's actually, I think he's very shrewd.
Well, we'll see if he takes a hiatus from Twitter. One show that
that's not likely to happen.
One show that is taking a hiatus, as you reported, Anne, on your blog, is Real Talk, which is a movie review program in the vein of At the Movies, which was Ebert and Roper's, and at first Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel's movie review program that turned into Roger Ebert and Richard Roper's movie review program. The show was hosted by Jeffrey Lyons and Allison Bales, but after 4 years and 200 shows with never a repeat episode, as you wrote, and the last show will be June 26th. I've watched it only periodically because it was on very late at night here in Los Angeles.
I never
watched it. Do you watch At the Movies?
I did watch At the Movies when people such as yourself were on it, but
once on the graveyard shift on Christmas Eve, but they never asked me back.
But they didn't ask a lot of people back, actually.
Well, I didn't click with Roper. You know, it wasn't. You could see that it wasn't going to be a happening thing.
I don't know how Harry Knowles clicked with Roper, but he was invited back a couple of times. He's the only one that I know of that was invited back once or twice, except for David Poland, who I think was invited back twice. But Harry Knowles seemed to be there every other week.
They were looking. I mean, I think they had a lot of guest people on. I mean, just in terms of finding the real partner, I thought Michael Phillips really was the best guy in the end. I like Deo Scott too, but you could see that he was a little dry for them.
Yeah, well, he's a serious journalist. A.O. Scott, yeah. Of course, one of the head film critics of the New York Times, and the person I mentioned earlier, Harry Knowles, runs a very popular website called Ain't It Cool News.
And he was great fun to see on the show. And I always enjoyed Kevin Smith when he was on because they're just so entertaining. But in terms of having a real, I mean, the two Bens, as I call them, or the two, you know, some people call them the two twits, Ben Lyons and Ben Mankiewicz, they have, I have to confess, gotten somewhat better. Not what real fans of criticism are looking for, I don't think.
Well, every week we kind of talk a little bit about some stuff that we like to call inside baseball. This week, the big news story was that Time Warner and AOL, which was a, as the Wall Street Journal puts it, a $100 billion merger back in 2000 that has become a sort of anti-playbook for corporate deals, they are now going to be splitting up. Time Warner will spin off AOL into its own company, and they will go on their internet way, and Time Warner, run by Jeff Bukes, will go the way of movies, television, and entertainment, which a lot of people had predicted this. A lot of people have been talking about this for years, and it's finally happening.
Yes, and I shouldn't have let go of my Time Warner stock because it's now going to go up.
Well, if you recall, back in 1999, 2000, when this whole thing happened, it was AOL with its inflated internet stock price that purchased Time Warner, the 100-year-old company. It was quite the news back then, and a lot of people felt there would be some
symbiotic relationship.
Correct.
AOL bought Time Warner? I thought it was just like a nice, happy merge.
No. AOL came in and bought Time Warner. And now, Time Warner is saying thank you, but no thanks. And so they're headed.
Well, it's been a real albatross for them for a while. And it's sort of old, and you know, the old portal concept, the idea of people going to a destination that was contained. It's so not what it is today, you know, where Google is everywhere and people are throwing widgets around, and you know, Google just makes everything so easy. I don't know if you guys use Gmail or
to Google. We do our show notes on Google Docs, so yeah,
exactly.
Yeah,
another story that insiders were talking about this week was the William Morris Endeavor merger. Now that they've laid off 100 employees, most of whom were agents and business affairs executives, it seems that they've just realized they can't maintain their level of clients, the number of clients they have. So they are beginning to let clients go, at least the clients they don't feel can make money.
And what I think is so interesting is that one of those clients is Winona Ryder.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Who actually was quite good in Star Trek, I thought, in small role.
Oh, I hated her in Star Trek.
Did you?
Okay, and you can't ever come back.
That's, Oh, God.
They dumped like Winona Ryder, Clifton Collins Jr., who played one of the murderers in Capote, both the Duff sisters, which, okay, but still, I mean, come on. Hilary Duff, Mark Lucas, Eugene Levy, David Alan Grier. I mean, okay, none of these people are top 2% talent. I just, you know, it's really a good thing for the Paradigms and the Gershes out there and the APA.
That's right. They're going to find representation. It's not the end of the world. It's a tough time in the industry. There's going to be a lot of this constriction, and it's going to be really hard for a lot of people. All these agents are going to have to find other places, and it's a lot of them are going to leave the business. A lot of them aren't going to be here.
Well, Nikki Fink got somebody to say that, or is reporting, that William Morris has said they only want to represent the top 2% of Hollywood talent. I would agree with you, Anne. It is not the end of the world. However, it is the end of our show. And nice segue to say we're wrapping up. I really appreciate your participating with us and coming on today.
I had fun. Thank you. It was a pleasure. And Karen, I know we didn't agree on every point, but
I have to tell you, Anne, very few people agree with Karen on many things. So
no, Karen doesn't agree with a lot of people on many things.
That's kind of what she's known for, and that's kind of one of the things that makes her charming in certain ways.
Thank you.
I had no place to go with that. I had no idea where that sentence was leading off a cliff.
All right. Well, it was my pleasure, and I'll keep listening.
Okay. Now, Anne, do you have anything you want to plug besides Thompson on Hollywood?
That's about it for the moment. I'm continuing to feed it. It's a hungry maw, but keep looking and follow me wherever I go. That's all I ask.
Well, we certainly will be letting people know where you land, and at some point it would be great to have you back on just to talk about what it's like to be a blogger these days, because it really is, it's become a profession, being an entertainment news blogger.
Well, whether it's a lucrative one is another question.
Well, thank you very much. I know you have to run off to a screening, so we can definitely...
So long.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Well, that was a lot of fun. To have Anne on. She's a really well-respected journalist in the entertainment world, and I've known her for years, or at least admired her for years, and I'm really glad she's one of our first guests.
Yeah, I hope she comes back, despite the fact that we didn't agree on much.
Well, you're getting quite the reputation.
I hope so.
If you're looking for links to any of the stories we talked about on today's episode, you can find them on our website, showbizsandbox.com. They will be in the episode show notes. If you want to email us to disagree with us or to agree with Karen or to disagree with Karen, as many people do.
Yeah, Dario, I mean you. You don't bother.
The email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can even call us and leave us a voicemail, although preferably a short one. The number is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263.
You can follow us on Twitter. We're on Facebook and LinkedIn.
Yes, we have a group on LinkedIn, which we have posted nothing to, but I will change that hopefully this week. We have a group on Facebook that we have posted nothing on, and I will try and change that this week. We have a Twitter account that I am setting up and has been set up, and we should start posting to that as well. So we're at the beginning stages of this.
Yeah, we're still young.
What else should we mention?
If
you want to send us news stories, please feel free either via email or voicemail, or you can tag them in Delicious, the social bookmarking website. Just tag them with the word Showbiz Sandbox, all one word.
Nice to talk to you again, Sperling.
Good to talk to you as well. Until next week, play nice.